It's 10 o'clock on the BBC, Nick Coffering for Justin this week. And this week, it's all about the bus. The bus? Which bus? The Wings tour bus from 1972. Have I got a great story for you today. So tonight, let me explain what we're going to do, because one of the beauties of doing a radio show at this time of night is we have the opportunity just to kick back and take a time a little bit and really go into something in depth. And I've got such a great story for you tonight. So there is a bus. Its number plate is WNO481. And for a short while, it was possibly the most famous bus in the world because it was the Wings tour bus. This was just when Paul McCartney took Wings on tour to Europe. He bought a bus. And he had it decorated, painted. It looked incredible. It was an open-top bus, and it toured southern Europe, then across up to Scandinavia. The bus then had a pretty incredible life. Some would say quite a mundane life at that. It was a bus in Dunstable and around St. Albans. It went to Tenerife for many years. And it was bought last year by a chap called Tom Jennings. And Tom's intention is to restore the bus to its former glory. So for the next, from about 10:15, for a good hour or so, we're going to look at the story of this bus. We'll chat to Tom, who can tell a story or two. He's got so many anecdotes about this bus and about the bus's musical and less musical history. We'll also hear from Geoffrey Cleghorn. Geoffrey painted the bus, and not only painted the bus, but he was artist to the stars in the 1970s. Keith Moon, among others, used his talents on a mural in his home. So we'll chat to Geoffrey Cleghorn. And I'm really, really excited by this because it's a massive thing to get someone from the original Wings band on the radio. Dennis Sidwell, who was the drummer, still very close to Paul McCartney. Just before I came on air, I had a lovely chat with Dennis, and I will play that out for you as part of this retrospective, this look back at the Wings bus. I think it's going to be rather lovely. I think you'll enjoy it too. Just after 10:10, right, let's go with this. We're going to have quite a bit of fun over the next 45 minutes, maybe even an hour. I'm determined to give this a nice bit of airtime because it's such a great story. So the number plate WNO481 may not immediately mean something to you, but then again, it might. In fact, it may actually belong to one of the most famous buses in the world. Believe it or not, if you live in and around St. Albans, Luton, Dunstable, that kind of area, you may even have ridden in it yourself. So what am I talking about? Well, in 1972, Paul McCartney and Wings went on tour. He commissioned a bus to take them on the road, and that bus became part of music folklore. It went on to have a very mixed life and is now being lovingly restored to its former Wings glory by a group of enthusiasts. And over the next hour or so, we'll hear from the man who painted the bus. He also painted murals for some of the biggest names of the era. We'll hear from the new owner, Tom Jennings, and in a rare radio interview, and I'm really, really chuffed with this, founding member of Wings, legendary drummer Denny Sidwell. We're going to have a lot of fun with this. If for any reason you have a link to the bus, maybe you rode on it in Luton in the 1980s, maybe you know someone who worked on the bus, I reckon that this bus has touched a lot of people. You can always drop me a text, 81333 is the text number, put Nick at the start of your text, or call us on your usual number. Let's start with the owner, Tom Jennings. Tom, I think this is a great story, and what I want you to do before we even start is, for anyone who's not seen this bus, just give me the potted history. What did it look like, and what's the story behind it?
Hello, Nick. Good evening to you, and good evening, everybody. After the breakup of the Beatles in 1970, the world of music was mourning the loss of its greatest ever band, and everybody, the whole world, wondered what John, Paul, George, and Ringo would do next. And surely, in the title of the song, would they get back together? Wouldn't they? We were reading everything into it. And then John went off, made his headlines. Woodstock 1969 was still ringing in everyone's ears. And in 1971-72, Paul McCartney got himself a double-decker open-top bus and turned it into Macca's mothership by having it painted in a Woodstock on Wheels peace and love psychedelic design. He then set off with family and band on board to kickstart loud and proud the legendary Wings phase of his musical life. And in 2 months, July and August 1972, Wings would perform 25 concerts in 25 cities in 9 countries across Europe, approximately 12,000 kilometers, 7,500 miles, and also give birth to timeless classic hit songs.
Yeah, and if you saw this bus, you wouldn't have missed it, because it was multicoloured, it was quite psychedelic, it was beautifully painted, and as you pointed out there, Tom, it was open top, so they were driving across the French Riviera and then up through Europe and then up towards Scandinavia, sitting on beanbags, enjoying the scenery.
And that's right, and half the stuff came out of Tom Salter's. Tom Salter used to own the gear boutiques in Carnaby Street. He was kind of Mr. Carnaby Street, and he decorated the bus. He fitted it all out for Paul, and a lot of the mattresses and beanbags and stuff actually came out of his own house.
Well, you mentioned Tom Salter there. He, of course, commissioned the artist to paint the bus. And one of those artists was a chap called Geoffrey Cleghorn, who lives in Suffolk. And Geoffrey was artist to many of the stars of the 1970s. He has a lot of stories to tell. In fact, I think we should get him back on this programme at a later date just to tell some of the other stories about The Who and many of the bands that he frequented. So he was asked to paint the bus. And his is a great story. So let's hear his story, starting with, well, why he left Ipswich.
Well, it was boring in Ipswich. I mean, I was 18, 19, wanted to move to London, so off we went. Off I went with two of us, actually. £20 each in the pocket. The other guy had a car, so... And you go get a job, things like that, and you meet people. I mean, I was really lucky. The third day I was in London, I met a guy who was older than me when at Ipswich Art School. He'd left 3 years before me, sort of thing. And... I got a new place to live, which was just off the King's Road, which was rather nice. A rather lovely basement in Old Church Street, Chelsea. She rented me the basement for £3 a week, which was pretty good.
forgive the cliche, but I've got this image of someone coming from the provinces, landing in London at a time which, let's be honest, it was as swinging as it ever was and ever will be.
Absolutely.
It must have been just a huge eye-opener for you.
No, I'd done lots of weekends in London. I had friends that were at college in London when I was at art school, and I used to come up and stay. And I had lots of good opportunities like that. I mean, I ended up getting a job in Carnaby Street, and once again, you meet lots of people. And I was good at the job, I must admit. I mean, they offered me the manager job when they opened a new shop in the King's Road, which I took. And I worked rather closely with a guy called David Salter, who was managing the Great Gear Trading Company, which was also in the King's Road. That was owned by Tom Salter, his brother. And obviously got to know Tom. We ended up... I mean, there were no social barriers. If you liked somebody and you got on, you spent time, you socialised. It was really, really, really laid back. It's that old cliche. There was a feeling in the air. You knew that something was going on, and if you knew what it was, you were lucky. That's cool, because most people didn't really. They plodded on as usual, you know. There was a spark, and if you had anything of that spark, you tended to get on okay, you know.
There weren't any
social barriers, and everybody wanted the same thing. Brave New World syndrome, you know how it is.
You clearly had a good nose for a good gig, and then someone decided to take a punt on you for this bus. What happened?
Well, Tom Salter was going to be promoted, and I mean, we'd been having lunch and things with Tom for a while, you know. He was just another guy we knew, you know, and you spend time with, have fun with, you know, go to parties, etc., etc., etc. And well, I mean, by then I'd left the retail trade, and we'd set up a really kind of loose, very loose company, producing bits of one-off artwork, make them out of wood, paint them up. Just, it was unusual. And shop fronts. I mean, I'd painted a mural for Keith Moon, you know, drummer with The Who, in 71. And that was only because I was going out with a girl that went to school with Keith Moon's wife, and they were still in touch.
And this was a 25-foot wide mural. This
was 25-foot long, roughly. It was he lived in a five-pyramid house, if you can work that one out. There was a big pyramid in the middle, and then another one stuck on each corner, and one of them was his bar. And this was in the bar that I done it.
What was the mural of?
it was Marvel Comics. I was really heavily into Marvel Comics, and it was a great meeting between about 12 or so characters, goodies versus baddies, lurking in the background in the bad section with Mephisto, the demon from the Silver Surfer comics. And Silver Surfer, Thor, Iron Man, etc., all steaming in from the left, ready to attack.
Sounds fantastic.
It was great. And the worst part about it is I've only got one photograph, and that only covers one tiny little part of it. It was a photograph that's been published of Keith Moon leaping around barefoot, having a little dance around the bar, and there's a bit of the mural in the background. There's a tiny bit of the Surfer and a little bit of the Thor.
It's almost like the power of art lies in the mystery. So the fact that this mural has only ever been seen in a tiny, tiny part of a tiny photo can only add to them. Listen, if you'd done this in 2020, you'd be a multimillionaire. It would be a work of street art that someone right now would be auctioning on a very, very expensive international auction. So there you were. You had connections with big artists. You were painting for them. The bus. How did that come about?
Tom said, I've got this job I'm promoting. I think we were sitting in the Casserole. It was a sort of lunchy, kind of quite camp restaurant in King's Road. Favourite place. All the girls from Quorum used to go there. So it was a nice place to be. And he was going on about this... he'd been asked to do, or he'd put in to do this tour thing, and it looked like it was coming off, and they were thinking of doing it on a bus. And, well, boys, he said, do you fancy having a go at it? We need this bus painted. We want to do it like a bit Yellow Submarine-y, blah, blah, you know. And another glass of wine was ordered, and it was an idea, and it gelled from there. And originally we were supposed to have about 10 days to do it, and there was a timetable, but... Well, we ended up with 4 days, basically. Tom was saying, oh, things haven't been signed, this and that, and there's cock-ups at the office, and, you know, but all the same, we got it done. We done it.
You're very nonchalant in describing one of the biggest music stars, rock stars, people, full stop, on the planet, coming to you and asking you to paint his bus.
He's just another bloke.
And that's how it felt at the time, just another job from another bloke.
Well, no, it felt great, because this was a Beatle, you know.
Yeah.
It felt great. Oh, wow, yeah, okay, we'll do that, we'll do a good job on it, you know. Of course it was good. It looks great in the CV, didn't it, you know. But... It was another job.
Who came up with the ideas as to what was to go on it? You say you chatted about it. Were these your designs? And what did you put on the bus?
Basically, how to fill a bus up with large blocks of colour in peculiar shapes that were going to attract attention as it rolled along the road at 45 miles an hour. Basically. It's like a billboard, but it's a moving billboard. So you haven't got to be too finicky about tiny little bits and pieces. It's wham, bam. Yeah. Wow. Whoa, look at that. Oh, you know, one of those.
Was McCartney involved in the process, or once you started?
Didn't meet him until, Grand Hotel Toulon. First of all, on the second day, Tom somehow, I don't remember if he came down to the garage or whatever, he said to me and Charlie, because it was our job, it was Charlie and I who took it on, and we then pulled in the rest of the crew, do you want a bonus? Do you want to come on the tour for a while? He said, there might be little fiddly things that need to be done. I don't know. He said, I don't know. He said, but if you've got a passport, do you want to come? We're leaving tomorrow. Yeah, okay, brilliant, bonus.
Were you there as an equal? Were you there as part of the tour, part of the band, part of the family, or were you the guys who painted the bus and were sat at the back and not allowed to be involved?
As far as I was concerned, we were there because we'd done a bloody good job, you know, and it was a bonus. That was the end of story, and it was a bonus. That was simple. We were savvy enough not to get in the way of the business. You can't do that, you know. Don't interfere. Just have a good time. That's what it was about. Have a good time.
Do you remember at the time getting a sense of how massive the story around the bus was? Because everyone wanted to know where this bus was and, you know, what Paul McCartney was up to and where he was. And did you get that sense while you were on the bus?
Not really. I for years afterwards, I had a feeling of disappointment that not more came of it. And I was quite, that's why I was quite excited when somebody found it, you know. And this whole thing is, it was something in its time, wasn't it, you know. But it was good. It's largely with the benefit of hindsight that the story's blowing up.
When you look back at your time on the bus, has 50-odd years enhanced the stories, or actually was it just a really simple part of your creative life? You did it, you went on the bus, you left the bus, and you left it behind.
Well, we had a good time. We felt we earned it.
Yeah.
You know, we earned the opportunity. It was a good opportunity. I'd never been to the south of France.
And there you are with an open top bus driving down, what is it, Route 7 or
Route
something?
Route 7, yeah.
As you head down towards the south of
people's eyes hanging out on stalks as they drove past.
At 45 miles an hour,
yeah,
maximum.
We were doing 45 and the Porsches were doing a lot more. Even the lorries were overtaking you, you know. But as soon as it had the name of the band on the back. It had a bloody great black and silver flying W on the back, and underneath, nicely sign-written, Paul and Linda McCartney, Denny Lane, Henry McCulloch, etc., 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 on the back of the bus. If you were behind the bus, you couldn't. It was right in front of you. Bump. And people were going, oh, Paul McCartney, oh, Beatles. You know, one of those ones.
Jeffrey Cleghorn, who was the artist who painted the bus, number plate WNO481 that Wings took on tour in 1972, being currently restored. It's in new ownership. Tom Jennings is determined to bring it back to its former glory. Coming up next, in a rare radio interview, we'll hear from Dennis Sywell, I beg your pardon, who was the drummer in the band, and he's got some amazing recollections of that time. Paul McCartney and Wings, Band on the Run. It's the longer version than the original album version. 10:30, you're listening to the BBC. So, we're making our way gently as the bus itself would have ridden, across a wonderful story. The bus WNO481, that was its number plate, was taken on tour by Paul McCartney and Wings in 1972. He wanted a tour differently, so he bought this open-top bus, had it painted by Jeffrey Cleghorn and Tom Salter. You just heard from Jeffrey Cleghorn a few moments ago. And off they went on tour with their wives, with their children, with beanbags on the top deck, and they pootled along the French Riviera, creating quite a stir, because at the time everyone wanted to know what Paul McCartney was up to. And that bus has since then had, well, quite a history. It's been used in local service in Dunstable and Luton and St Albans, in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. It's been to Tenerife, and it's finally back in the hands of a music loving owner, Tom Jennings, who bought it last October and is restoring it to its former glory. Very shortly we'll hear from Denny Sywell, who was the drummer in that band and on that tour. But Tom, I think we should just catch up a little bit on how this bus came into your hands, because there is a link, isn't there, between a guitar and the bus. Join the dots up for me.
Well, in 2019, I was looking to buy a vintage guitar and ended up buying a vintage bus.
This is what happens.
It's just, you know, don't come home from the pub and then go on eBay. That's the lesson to learn here. But this is not what happened here in this case, although things have happened in the past like that. But I was surfing the internet looking for a vintage guitar, and one caught my eye that had been used for many years by one of my singing heroes, country legend Hank Locklin. Hank had a beautiful voice, and In my mind's eye, I had all his albums, and I learned all his songs. And in my mind's eye, I could picture the guitar on Hank's albums. And I saw him live back in the 60s when I was very young. So I gazed at this guitar many times. So it was featured on the Heritage Auctions website. But by the time I got there, followed the link through, it had been sold. And I even said to the guy, you know, if whoever bought it wants to make a little bit of a profit, I'd be written out. Didn't want to know. The guy was really, really happy with it. So that was that. So I was just searching around, and then something really big caught my eye: Elvis Presley's tour bus. Now, I'm a huge fan of Elvis, and when I followed the link to that, it had been sold in 2015. And I thought, wow, okay. So I looked at that, and that was very, very interesting. And I reckon that because I clicked on Elvis's tour bus, a few days later, I received information that Paul McCartney's 1972 Wings tour bus was coming up for auction. Now, I was only looking, But it was the first I'd heard of the bus in years, and so many theories were flying around about what became of her that she became almost a myth, like an albatross or a unicorn. So I made a mental note to have a look, just out of interest, to see what Paul McCartney's bus sold for. So later, a few days later when I checked, I was astonished. It hadn't received one bid in the auction. And then I read the auction description, and it didn't match up at all to what I thought the bus should have written about it. I got outraged. I thought it shouldn't have a mere description, but a provenance, and it should read, you know, something like, oh, you know, WNO481, this international treasure on wheels, is firmly parked at the intersection of time capsule art, timeless chopping music, rock and roll, classically beautiful automotive design and heritage. I could go on, but this is.
But they didn't.
This, for me, this was a true one-off. It's not like a, you know, multiple, you know, vehicles they use in movies. This is the actual one-off. This is the actual movie, the bus that's in all of the 1972 Wings Over Europe tour videos.
And come on, be honest, Tom. You always wanted to be the driver, didn't you?
Well, I did. I was 11 when the Beatles exploded in 1962. And so I'd been, you know, I was singing, and as my dad once said, when he heard me sing in the band, he said, wow, he said, they don't run away when you start singing. And I thought, well, that's kind of about it, really. That's kind of the measure. So I was playing guitar and I was singing, and that was it. All my mates wanted to do that. My friend Steve, he actually told me a story a couple of years ago. He said that he announced to his mum when he was about 16 that he was actually going to join the Beatles.
Yeah.
He said, I play bass guitar. He said, Paul McCartney's my hero. He said, and I think John, Paul, George and Ringo should move up a bit and let me in the band.
So and they probably should have. So this bus that hadn't received a single bid, you've obviously, it's then got under your skin, and that's an understatement. You've then gone to the owner, haven't you? You said, look, we can do a deal here, can't we?
We did. It was very long and protracted. And the thing that impressed me most, I mean, I used to buy, do up and sell cars and vans and stuff. And, you know, I've got the radar for the BS. And, you know, Justin was not putting out any BS. All he wanted, he bought it because he was the second savior of the bus. Roger Wyatt was the first savior in 1982 when Tricentral was selling it. And Justin James, he saved the bus when it was in Tenerife and could have ended up in a Spanish scrapyard. So he got it back to the UK, and it cost him a lot of money to do that. I mean, to transport something from Tenerife, you know, get it back to the UK.
It was really falling apart, wasn't it? I mean, it was hardly in good shape.
It was. It wasn't in good shape. And, you know, but to me, it just had this aura about it. It just had this magic. And I bought it. Yeah, I mean, he sent me a video, and he said, well, this is what the bus looks like. So he did a walk around, and he did a walk up the stairs, and this, that, and the other, and he showed it to me. I mean, you know, I used to do body work, mechanical, welding, all that kind of stuff. And I thought, all right, that needs doing. So I'm making a list in my head of all the things that he's doing. And I thought, well, if I have to get hands on myself, then I will. But I could, the cogs were really, really spinning. You know, I mean, I had a garage back in the 70s and the 80s. And so, you know, it wasn't the biggest challenge in the world. It's a big challenge, though. But it is not the biggest challenge in the world.
It is a huge challenge. If you want to see this bus, such as it was back in 1972, loads of choices. But the easiest thing is just type its number plate in. If you go to your search engine and type WNO481, the images are all there. That number plate is unique. So WNO481 or the Wings Tour Bus. It's quite a story. The next chapter is about to be written because you're hearing Tom has bought the bus and has very sensibly, I mean, very economically sound logic there, Tom, to restore this rusting bus to its former glory. Coming up after guess what, Paul McCartney and Wings, we'll hear from Denny Sywell, who was a drummer in the band, and he was on tour in the bus, and I tell you what, his recollections are absolutely lovely. We'll do that after Jet. Paul McCartney and Wings, Jet. You're listening to the BBC, Saturday night, headed towards 10:45. Telling you what I think It's just a great story. It's a great piece of social and cultural history. The story of WNO 481, the Wings tour bus that toured Europe in 1972. The beautifully painted Wings tour bus, painted by Geoffrey Cleghorn, who we heard from a little bit earlier on. Geoffrey from Suffolk, originally from Ipswich, came down to London, found himself painting murals for Keith Moon, as you do, and then got asked to be part of this project, painted the bus. If you want to see what the bus looks like, just go to your search engine and type WNO 481. There'll be lots of pictures of it there. We've also been chatting to Tom Jennings. Tom made the economically very sensible decision to buy the bus last year and restore it. He's bringing it back to its former glory, and I think Tom himself would admit that it's a labour of love. I promised you that we'd hear from Denny Sywell, and I'm really, really chuffed that I'm able to bring you Denny Sywell tonight. Denny, of course, was in the original Wings lineup. He was Paul McCartney's drummer, and he went on tour in WNO 481. And just before I came on air, I was really, really thrilled to catch up with Denny. He's in Los Angeles. He's just been teaching. He's still teaching, of course, a very, very skilled drummer. I caught up with Denny. I had to ask him, first question, how did this all come about? How did he end up in Wings?
Yeah, I met Paul in New York when he came to New York to audition drummers to make the Ram album. I was one of the 10 or 12 guys who was doing all the best work in town. And he had a list, and we met in this clandestine kind of a basement. It was really a strange audition. I walked in, and I see him sitting in the corner with Linda, and I said, "Hey, you're Paul McCartney." He goes, "Yeah, I know that." And finally, he said, "I'm looking for a drummer. Do you mind playing for me?" I played. We hung out a few minutes. We laughed, and he liked the way I played and my attitude, and he hired me for the Ram record. A couple of months later, he invited me to Scotland to hang out and, you know, just spend some time, take a vacation. And while there, he said, "I miss my old band, and I'd like to form a band. Would you like to join in a band with me?" And I said, "Of course, you know, I'd be honored." So we sold everything in New York, moved to London, and that was it. And Paul always had these strange ideas about touring. One of the very first things he talked about, even when we were recording Ram in New York, was putting a band together and going around Brazil in a horse-drawn carriage, you know, like a band of gypsies. And, you know, when we finally put Wings together in London, we had the four of us, we put the record Wildlife out, and then Henry McCulloch was added, so we had a full band for live performing. We did the European tour was the second one. We did the university tour
The colleges and universities across the country,
yes.
Didn't you? Yeah.
And
that was relatively low-key, wasn't it?
Very low-key. We wanted to go out and just surprise everybody, you know, because they were all going to be comparing it to the last time they saw the Beatles anyway. Paul wanted to give the world a look at a new band and an honest look. And the same with that record, Wildlife, which is, when you really listen to it, it was a wonderful record. But yeah. Very little thought was put into it. And it was all good vibes. We were a family, and we were traveling in a 12-passenger van. Paul drove half the time. And we had wives, kids, and dogs, and it was an adventure.
I can't quite let you get away with the nonchalant way you talk about the audition, though, because have you ever been as nervous as you were auditioning in front of McCartney? Or actually, you make it sound like it was just really quite natural.
It was, actually, simply because I've been recording with Billy Joel and James Brown, and I played, you know, as a New York session guy, it was another beautiful recording situation every week or every 3 or 4 days. We'd make another record, so I was used to it. I wasn't used to meeting a Beatle, and Paul was definitely the top of that heap, but I wasn't nervous simply because, you know, I had that past experience, and I had my talent as a drummer. I didn't feel like I had to take a back seat to anybody, especially then, you know.
Especially a Beatle. Did you feel an instant connection? Did you guys bond very quickly?
Oh, yeah, very quick. He said, "Would you like to play some drums?" I said, "Yeah, you have a bass or a guitar or something to play with?" He says, "No, just you." And I went, "Oh, I guess if you can't get it on by yourself, how can you get it on with somebody else?"
Yeah.
And he liked that. It was, in its time, it was very apropos. And so what I did was immediately I went into my Ringo. I channeled Ringo, and I'm, you know, tom-toms flailing away, and just had a little fun with it. Since it was an awkward situation, we made it fun. I made it fun, and he liked it.
It sounds like he did. So over to London you came, and you were kind of swinging between London and Scotland, weren't you, at this time? How did that work? So were you moving together, or were you moving separately? Because you were very much based in the two places.
Well, when we left New York and moved over, we went straight to Scotland, and we rented a farm over the hill from his farm, and we had our own place. We'd show up every day at his farm to go to the rehearsal. We rehearsed in one of the barns over there, and we would just get ready for this record that we were going to record in London. Then we all flew down. We took a private jet down to London, and we recorded that Wildlife album. Maybe in a weekend, we did the tracks, and then we spent the rest of maybe a couple of weeks finishing them off and mixing and everything. But that record was done within 2 weeks for sure. And five of the eight tracks were first takes in the recording studio.
And as you say, it's an album that merits re-listening, certainly 49 years on. So let's go to the tour. So you've toured the universities. The students there probably couldn't believe their luck that Wings have toured in our colleges and universities. Paul has then said, look, we're going to go to Europe. We're going to start in the south of France. We're going to take a bus. Well, what do you remember about the first time you heard about this bus?
Oh, I thought, great. Yeah, what a nice way to go around the south of France. And especially, you know, I had no idea that it would only go 35 miles an hour, though.
And apparently, if it had to go up a hill, it had to reverse. I've heard anecdotal evidence that it had to be in reverse gear to even make it up some of France's steep hills.
It's true.
Do you remember the first time you saw it?
Yes, I believe it was Chateau Vallon. we were in our hotel, and we looked down, and there's this beautiful painted up blue bus, you know. I went, oh, that's the bus. So we went down all excited and everything. So the first time on the bus, I remember we were up on the top deck was laid out with, it had a few seats in the very front, but it had mattresses for sunbathing in the south of France, you know. So, and the kids could jump around. There was a playpen and the mattresses. It was very safe to be up there. So we were up there just having fun one day, and the bus is going along through the vineyards in the south of France and everything. And all of a sudden, I was standing up and just joking around as I usually was. And one of the guys, I don't remember if it was Denny or Henry, tackled me because we went through a low bridge. And if I was standing up, it would have taken the top of my head off.
This is not funny, but it is funny. I think it's really important just to get a sense of this image here, that this isn't a tour bus. This is a bus without a roof. This is an open-top bus that one of the biggest artists of the era was dragging his brand-new band around Europe when everyone wanted to know where McCartney was and what he was doing. And everything was visible from the outside. It at times must have felt just totally surreal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The paint job. I mean, people used to come by us on the motorways and everything, and they would just freak out when it had our names on the back of the bus and everything. It was quite a trip. You know, it was really a lot of people just made a big fuss over seeing that. And, you know, we pulled into the, the Cap d'Antibes in the Eden Rock Hotel, probably one of the most expensive hotels in the world.
Yeah.
I could just see that bus pulling in there next to all of the fancy cars in the parking lot, and here's this hippie bus, you know, a bunch of crazy guys jumping all around, taking weird pictures and stuff, and dogs running around. So it was a fun tour.
I'm going to phrase this question very carefully, Denny. Do you remember much about that tour? And I'm using the phrase very reservedly.
Of course. I remember. You mean, was I high most of the time?
I was not going there, but I was wondering wondering whether the bus was fueled by petrol or other things.
No, no, no. Okay. I'll tell you something. It was a mamby-pamby band. We there really wasn't a lot of drugs in that band. You know, we smoked a little bit of weed once in a while, and a couple of times we'd have a couple of drinks afterwards. It really wasn't like some of the bands of the same time. I mean, it was in no league, in the same league as a lot of bands were. You know, we had wives and kids with us and stuff, and an image of the Beatles, you know, nobody wanted to be drunk or high either. You know, we thought it was very important that we gave our best performances, because we knew we were going to be judged till the last time they saw the biggest band in the world.
Yeah. I wonder whether you described the band almost as a family, and the families brought their families, and whether that was the watchword of the whole tour. It almost feels like, yes, it has a sense of community and strong, tight family about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Paul and Linda were the best parents that we'd ever seen, and Henry had his kids with him, or his kid Jesse with him, and we didn't have any kids, but the wives were along. We had dogs, we had kids, you know. My wife just told me there were no dogs. Oh, that was later on. Okay, yeah, because we were going to different countries. That's right.
Urban myth for the dogs. What happened below deck? So the upper deck is all the beanbags and the chilling out. Downstairs, was it like a traditional tour bus? Were there tables? Were there beds?
There were several tables, and there was like a couple of bunk beds in the back. They were probably there for the kids. They weren't for any of the band members. I mean, we just got on the bus and made our next destination. And I remember there were several times where if we had to go like 150, 200 miles between cities, it would take, you know, at 35 miles an hour, it would take quite a while. And there were times where the promoter at the other end would send some BMWs out on the motorway to pick us up and rush us to the venue, so we got there in time to start the concert. I remember once in Germany, there was a BMWs, five lime green BMWs showed up on the motorway. We got off the bus. We each got into one of these lime green BMWs and did like 150 miles an hour into the venue.
True rock and roll. True rock and roll to the end. Listen, I've got a question for you. There's a group of volunteers around the renovation of this bus, and they're called the Busketeers. And one of them, Andrew, has actually asked me to put a question to you, and I'm more than happy to do so. So he says, could you ask Denny, were there any Cliff Richard summer holiday moments? Did anyone actually get behind the wheel and or sing the song at any point?
Or did you have drivers?
There was a driver.
I believe the man's name was Pat.
Right.
And I'll never forget. Paul still talks about him very fondly. We were talking about the night we stayed at the Cap Don Teves Eden Rock Hotel, and he said, "Oh yeah, $35 hard-boiled eggs." And I remember Pat used to go down in the morning. We were there for 5 days or something. I think his name was Pat. Anyway, English bloke with a little funny little top hat on and everything. He would go down by the pool and he'd have his $50 glass of orange juice, and you know, it was a very expensive place, you know. But we'd say that he loved it. He had a great time, and he said, Pat would say, "Yeah, when I get home, I'm going to throw my hat in the door. My wife bends over to pick it up, and it's all over."
And
he had a great sense of humor, but he did all of the driving because, you know, that took a lot of load off of us.
You were never tempted to take the wheel. Did you know what comes across, Denny, talking to you, is just a huge amount of affection for that period and for that tour, and dare I say, for that bus. It's just coming across with such warmth.
Yeah, it was brilliant because there was nothing... there was nothing fancy about it. I mean, the paint job was just lovely. I mean, I forget the artist's name now, but they did an incredible job. Was it?
There was Jeffrey Cleghorn and one other whose name momentarily escapes me, but there was two primary artists. Yeah, and they did a great job, didn't they?
Oh, it was awesome. It was awesome. We still have all of the pictures. You know, we'd always take some pictures here and there, and we'd pull into castles. You know, sometimes. Paul, I don't know who made the arrangements for this tour, but we stayed in places that you could not stay unless you were a Beatle, you know.
Yeah.
And we had the Baron be cooking breakfast. How would you like your eggs this morning? I said, "Well, Baron, I think I'm going to have some bacon and eggs over easy." It was pretty wild, though, and we stayed in some beautiful, beautiful places. The tour lost money at the end. We sold out a 28-city tour of Europe, but I don't think we did very well financially. But it's a memory that ingrained in our brains for forever.
Yeah, and you've maintained a strong relationship with Paul McCartney as well. You hinted at it there with how you're still in touch with him. I must ask you one final question. That is that
sure.
you've got this new owner, Tom Jennings. He's bought the bus a year ago. He's having it renovated, having it restored, and it's going to be back to its full glory. How does that feel for you? You're based in LA, obviously we're looking at 48, 49 years ago. Does it matter to you? Does it feel nice that this bus is going to come back to what it once was?
Oh, sure it does. Everything should come full circle. But those were such formative years, you know. I mean, they were very profound in many ways as far as my life went, you know, as going from a top session guy to becoming a band guy and perform, being part of a band called Wings. And that bus was a big part of it because the European tour was, that was our breaking out. That was the other stuff before that was nice, but this was saying, okay, we're ready now. And we had put a lot of hard work into becoming a real band. And the last tour that I did was the British tour. And by that time, we were really solid as a high performing, one of the top bands in the land.
Denny Sywell, who is the Wings drummer, was on that tour on the Wings bus WNO481, which went on to become part of music folklore and a music legend. You can hear the affection in which he holds the bus, in which he holds the band, the respect in which he still holds Paul McCartney. And that audition story, turning up being one of 12 session drummers in New York, having to audition for Paul McCartney, and just basically having no backing, no vocals, just the drums, and him and Paul McCartney clearly hit it off and still have a close relationship. I'll just come back to Tom Jennings, who's the new owner of WNO481. He's restoring this bus lovingly and at some considerable cost. And Tom, when you hear Denny Sywell's story there, that must touch you.
That just makes it all worthwhile. I mean, that just confirms the aura that I feel. I was 21 in 1972. And I was the same as everybody else. I was just looking for every scrap of news that was going on with John Paul, George, and Ringo. And when Paul went off on this adventure, this bus was just being talked about so every single day for the 2 months of the tour. And to hear Denny, you know, coming from inside the bus as it was on tour, where I wished I could have been, that just confirms the aura that I've got. Denny's got that aura as well. Beautiful to hear him, you know, saying that the bus was such a big part of it. And by the time that was an incubator, that bus, they were just getting together on the university tour. But Tom Doyle, in his book Man on the Run, which is a great read, He's got one chapter devoted to the bus, and the head of the chapter says, "Life in the slow lane." And the first line of the chapter goes, "Its top speed was an unimpressively chugging 38 miles an hour." but basically, then he went on to explain that this was perfect for Paul McCartney because he wasn't rushing anywhere. He was building a bond with these guys that were taking over from John, George, and Ringo.
And what's so interesting, hearing the stories, is that, I mean, this was a rock and roll bus, but it didn't sound like the most rock and roll lifestyle. The kids were on the bus. I don't even think Denny was being discreet there. I think it was just relatively quiet. There didn't seem to be any huge amounts of illicit drugs, apart from, he said, a little bit of marijuana. It sounds like this was a sensible tour.
It was in many, many respects. But of course, with Paul, there was always that element of zany, which carried him through, the Beatle years. And he's never really lost it. Paul always has, like a quiet riot. But to see the family on board, I mean, how many rock stars do that? I mean, Mick Jagger once said, you know, oh, look, he's got his old lady on tour with him. You know, that was actually at the time.
Yeah.
And Paul went, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And Paul wrote so many songs because of Linda, because of the love he had for Linda. She made him, she inspired him to write songs. And the children were with them, and everybody's girlfriend, or all the guys, their girlfriends, their wives, they were able to come as well. So it was like, I mean, if you look at Willie Nelson in America, I think there's about 21 people travel with Willie Nelson. It's a totally family on tour.
Yeah.
So there were many things to inspire Paul. And Paul is a person who looks around everywhere, both in the music world and in the art world, for inspiration. And he was a proper, as he proved, family man. Him and Linda were together for well over 20 years.
Yeah,
great relationship.
I've got one last little treat for you, because I'm determined to bring this story a little bit bang up today after it left the Wings tour, what happened to it after that, and coming up after My Love. I've got someone who, well, may just have a first-hand account as to what happened to that great bus. That's coming up after Wings. We've had a bit of a musical history treat, if I'm honest, and those of you that know me well know that I love a bit of cultural history, a bit of musical history, and we've been talking about WNO481, the Wings tour bus that took Paul McCartney and Wings on tour in Europe in 1972. It had a wonderful tour. It then had a very interesting life. It's had several owners who've looked after it, and it's been bought by a chap called Tom Jennings, who lives in North London, and he's now restoring it to its former glory. He's got a whole load of busketeer volunteers helping him piece together the history. And Tom, I said that we'd finish with a little bit of bringing the history up to date. And this is what we're going to do, because yesterday on my home radio station, BBC Three Counties Radio, you spoke to Andy Collins on The Breakfast Show. And one of the things that Andy said was, look, you're looking for anyone that can join some of the dots of WNO481's story when it was in and around Dunstable and Luton and St Albans and local to our patch, local to where I live. And we took a call from a chap called Chris Edwards. Chris, meet Tom. Tom, meet Chris.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm very good, Chris. Tell me.
Well, here's the thing, Tom, because Chris's dad has got had so many close links to this bus, both at the point that it was bought by Wings and then the point at which it came into the local area. So Chris, tell me the story. Let's go back to when the bus was bought by Paul McCartney and Wings.
Well, the at the time, my dad was a transport manager for Silver Line Coaches in Hounslow, who had previously, I think, brought out Halls of Hounslow that I think were the original owners of the bus prior to that. And anyway, he'd said to my older brother one day, he was working on for Silver Line also, oh, we got something up the yard that might be of interest to you. By this time, it had been all painted up, ready to go out on this tour. Well, my older brother Stan obviously was a big, big Beatles fan, and my dad took him over to see it before it went out. And I presume the bus then went out on the tour, come back, or it was obviously put back into service somehow. Well, when Tri-Central took over Silver Line in 1973, they was a big sort of multinational company that was into everything. A lot of the operations from Hounslow and a lot of the coach fleet was then moved up to Tavistock Street in Dunstable. Well, at around that time, my dad had got a transfer from Silver Line in London up to Milton Keynes, was offered, got a new house in Wolverton and stuff like that. And anyway, my dad got a job actually just driving, obviously, because he did got a transfer, so he sort of taking sort of what job that was on offer at the time. And initially, he was located in what would have been Buckmaster Coaches in Leighton Buzzard, which is another coach company that Tri-Central had purchased. Well, about 8 months after that, he was transferred to Tavistock Street in Dunstable. Anyway, lo and behold, when he started there was WNO481 in its glory. By this time, painted up in the Tri-Central corporate colours, which was mustard and white. And there it was. And it was used throughout the 70s, especially in the Jubilee year. It was out most weekends on sort of different, perhaps street parties and carnivals, that sort of thing. I remember that really well. Well, by this time, I was going up the coach yard with my dad at the weekends and school holidays, helping out in the yard, cleaning the coaches out and stuff. My another brother of mine, Brian, he also worked there as well. And one of the frequent jobs was to actually clean all the leaves out in the top of the bus where it was parked under these trees. if the wind, it had a torno cover over the top of it to sort of cover up the open top at the, you know, part to stop it getting weathered. And but sometimes that would blow off and it would fill up with leaves because it was parked up next to this oil tank that got all these trees around it. Of course, the leaves would fall off and all fill the bus up with these leaves. So I've often had the job of cleaning it out.
Did you know that that was the Wings bus?
Initially, no. It was when my dad told me, actually. He said that was used in the on the Wings tour sort of thing, you know, at the time. I was only 12, 13, so although it didn't seem significant at the time, it became more significant as I got to know the bus, you know.
What are the chances of your dad being there at the start when it was purchased for the tour and then randomly being transferred to Bletchley and Dunstable and that bus coming back to him there? I mean, there's something quite fate about that, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. It's quite ironic, really. Interestingly enough, one of the other coaches that was moved from Hounslow up to Dunstable was an executive coach that was previously used by the England football squad at Silver Line. That was transferred up to Dunstable with WN0481, and that was subsequently used for Luton Town's football coach as well.
Was that 484?
No, that was an AEC Plaxton. That was an executive coach. It was all like tables in it and fancy lights and stuff. But oddly enough, that was used in 1975 on the John Lodge and Justin Hayward Blue Jays tour.
How interesting.
Yeah, which is funny, really, considering that Denny Lane has been with, was joined Wings on the tour bus, quite ironic.
Do you know, here we are on the radio talking about buses, and part of me thinks this might well be a first. But what I love about this is the history of this bus and how, you know, it went from being this beautiful, psychedelic, multicoloured tour bus being ridden in by perhaps the world's biggest star of the time to carting people around Dunstable and Luton. There's something quite wonderful about it, isn't there?
I mean, it was used quite a lot on sort of corporate events, you know, going to Epsom races, stuff like that, mainly for corporate sort of dues, you know. I even think it was used for some weddings, because I remember one weekend I had to clean it out and there was all confetti everywhere. Well, that was horrible to clear up, that was.
I can imagine. When did you last see her, Chris?
When my dad retired from Tri-Central in 1979, unfortunately, he had suffered a heart attack, so he had to give up his PSV licence. But we used to go up to the yard quite a lot, and it was there. The last time I see it was actually in Bletchley, the Bletchley Carnival, because my sister and her friend Alison were on top of it. And also, I remember the drivers that used to frequently drive it. There was a guy called Maurice Kitt. He was one of the managers. Maurice Kingham, Johnny Gain. There was three of the sort of main drivers of WN0481. Because, of course, not everybody driving the coaches had a double-decker licence, you see. There was only... Because it's another
licence
altogether.
And here's the thing, Tom. You know, you think you're restoring a bus that that Wings toured in as a big part of rock history. But the more important thing is Chris's sister and Alison were on the upper deck at one point here. Tom, okay, so let's
sort out the leaves and everything from the leaves to the confetti.
To the confetti.
Exactly. Yeah.
Chris, one of the things that I've noticed during the searching for everything for the restoration is that the I went chasing all over Facebook and all over the internet looking for aircraft seats, because I used to fit aircraft seats in our band vehicles when I used to run a band. And I got an email back to say, Tom, mate, these are not aircraft seats. They've come off a coach. And when I checked and did all the research again, they actually came off of a coach, a Plaxton coach, identical to the England team coach, the 1970 England team coach.
And there's your link that Chris was alluding to there as well.
Yeah, I see.
And that's what you were saying there. So they must have got a stock of them, but the tables and the chairs, the two facing two, with a table in between, that's off a Plaxton executive or, you know, one of the others that you were mentioning.
Tom and Chris, what I'm going to do is, if it's okay with you, Chris, pass your contact details on to Tom as well.
Please.
Because I know Tom loves hearing these stories. Chris, I appreciate your time and waiting up so late and bringing us a little bit of the post Wings history of WNO 481. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Okay, thanks very much.
Fabulous.
Chatting to you all.
Good stuff, Chris.
Great to connect. Thank you very much indeed. We'll stay in touch.
Lovely.
Yeah, most definitely.
Tom, this has been a really, really nice hour. If I say so myself, and I'm more to the point, I hope that the listeners have found it a really good listen, because it's just been a really, really lovely part of rock history that we've been able to bring to the radio here. And for you, hearing the stories, hearing Denny Seiwald talking, hearing Jeffrey Cleghorn, this must bring your whole project to life.
Well, absolutely. And as I said, it confirms the aura that I feel that the bus has. And what I want, what I wish for, is that the bus will once more carry Paul McCartney's message in the artwork. We come in peace. We come to play. We come to have a good time. So join us.
Yeah.
And that's what myself and we're busketeers. We are nearly 50 now and growing, and of course I must thank number one busketeer, and that's my wife Rose, who has literally been the wind beneath these wings, sorry about the pun, but
and
she's
not checked
amazing.
Your bank account for a year, which is probably a good thing. Listen, Tom, before we leave you, just give us all the details. Where can we find the website, the socials, just so anyone that wants to either follow the story or perhaps even get in touch with you if they've got a story, how can they do that?
Absolutely. Paul McCartney calls the bus the 1972 Wings Tour Bus. And so we have 1972wingstourbus.com. 1972wingstourbus@gmail.com
is the email address. So 1972wingstourbus@gmail.com or 1972wingstourbus.com for the website. Get in touch with Tom and his team there, Andrew and his other busketeers, if you've got any stories. If you just want to find out how the restoration is going, because as I'm sure you will have noticed, Tom, we're 18 months away from, well, 20 months away from the 50th anniversary, and I would be very surprised if you won't be looking to mark that in somewhere with the bus. Tom, I appreciate all of your time. I appreciate your help this week in putting this all together. It's been really, really nice to have the opportunity to tell the story, and good luck with the renovation.
Nick, thank you so much for taking the story and running with it so beautifully. To hear Jeffrey waxing lyrical and to hear Denny Seiwald, just a thrill beyond belief. Thank you so much. You've done a fantastic job.
Well, you're very kind, but most importantly, we've all had a chance to hear the great story. There's Tom Jennings. Listen, if you're just joining us, I don't know how best to rewind, but basically that was the story of the 1972 Wings Tour Bus. So the bus that Paul McCartney commissioned got painted by Jeffrey Cleghorn. They went on tour with it, open air, open top bus, beanbags up on top of deck, Denny Lane, Denny Seiwald, Paul McCartney. They went on tour with it, and the bus then went into normal service in and around Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, then went to Tenerife. It's finally come back home. Tom has bought it and is restoring it. 1972wingstourbus.com if you want to find out more. And if you ever came across the bus, we heard there with Chris, his dad knew the bus very, very well indeed, and he's got very clear memories of it. So if you've got some memories that might join some of their dots, I'm sure they'd be delighted to hear from you. I'll tell you what, let's finish with this.